author Ellen Fitzpatrick. Her new book is The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency. Ellen is a professor of history at the University of New Hampshire, and she chronicles the history of the effort by women in America to win the White House. Hillary Clinton is far from the first and just the latest to get this far. Ellen, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Coy.
Let's begin with the title itself, The Highest Glass Ceiling. That actually comes from a conversation that Hillary Clinton had with a heckler, if I'm not mistaken. Can you tell us that story?
Yes. In the 2008 presidential primary, the Democratic primary, Hillary Clinton was campaigning in Salem, New Hampshire, and she was at a high school auditorium and was giving her, you know, sort of usual remarks when a couple of hecklers stood up and began to chant, "Iron my shirt, iron my shirt," and they were holding signs to that effect. They had actually been deployed as a stunt by a Boston radio station, but then Senator Clinton responded to them by, she sort of laughed and she said, "Ah, the remnants of sexism alive and well," and went on to say that this was part of the reason that she was running to break through this highest, hardest glass ceiling. And, of course, when she conceded that race to Barack Obama, she mentioned putting 18 million cracks in the ceiling when she referred to the votes that she had gotten in the 2008 primary.
So your book, as a historian, Ellen, you looked at the backstory and the historic context for this unprecedented run for the White House by Hillary Clinton, and unprecedented in terms that it actually looks like she will be the Democratic nominee at this point. Share with us the sort of the big arc story of the book, the elevator speech, and then we'll get into some specifics of who these women were and why their stories are still important today.
Well, I was intrigued by this subject because it occurred to me that although there had been, I knew, other women that had run for president, we knew remarkably little about them. And each time a woman candidate entered the race in the late 20th century or the early 21st century, there was always a bit of discussion about, could this be the first woman president? But it occurred to me that we knew very little about the women that had preceded more contemporary candidates, and I wondered if there was a story there. It turned out that there was. Over 200 women have made an effort, however small, over the course of American history to seek the presidency. Some of them were quixotic campaigns. They just appeared on a state ballot, and most of them got no traction. But the three women that I profile in this book actually did spark a national conversation about the idea of having a woman chief executive. There was a great deal of interest in their candidacies within their historical moment, and they emerged from particular historical conditions as well. So all of that seemed very intriguing to me, and that is the story that I tell in this book.
So Victoria Woodhull ran for the White House. Was she the first woman to do this? And this is back during Reconstruction in 1872. Who was she, and why does her story in particular jump out at you, Ellen, as a historian?
Well, she's a fascinating figure because she ran for president at a time, of course, when women could not vote. They were not enfranchised and fully until the 19th Amendment was ratified in 1920. So here's Victoria Woodhull. She actually announced her candidacy in 1870, 2 years before the election, vying 50 years earlier before she couldn't even vote for herself. She said, "I can't vote, but I can be voted for." And her story really emerges from the story of Reconstruction, when there was a lively debate and really process underway to define the parameters of American political rights and democracy in the aftermath of the Civil War. There were 4 million emancipated slaves, and the Congress was debating the time that Woodhull comes on the scene, the 14th and 15th Amendments to the Constitution, and the 14th Amendment, of course, conferring citizenship on African-American men, and the 15th removing any prohibitions against their voting. So this was a very fraught moment in which the women's suffrage movement, very active in the late 19th century and early 19th century for that matter, sought to press their case to get women included under these provisions. And they thought, you know, this was a very promising moment, they hoped, for their cause. And it was out of that mix that Victoria Woodhull steps forward first to try to advance women's enfranchisement, and then as a candidate for the presidency herself.
She is, of course, fighting a very long cultural tradition when women, wives, were treated like little girls. They were, in many cases, treated like property of men. Though we should point out that among the very first legislation considered by the very first Congress in 1790 was a proposal to grant women the right to vote, which was, which was, of course, denied because of that cultural tradition that, well, you can't give them the right to vote because they're just going to, they can't think for themselves because they're like children and they'll do what their husbands tell them to do. So that's basically giving a husband two votes. And so that's why it was denied for so many years.
I think people, those are very good points. I think people don't always appreciate the extent to which the demand for suffrage, women's suffrage, was really so radical, because it sought to redefine that very definition that you just laid out. That is, the idea emerged as a, during the American Revolution, that the proper role for women would be to be Republican mothers. That is, their role in the new republic would be as the wives and sisters and daughters of citizens, and that they could, in that capacity, help to raise virtuous men who would be well equipped to protect and promote this new republic, this fragile young democracy. And that was a role that was reserved for women as they pursued their domestic duties as wives and mothers. So voting rights, the effort to get the vote for women and to really improve their political status in this way, challenged that whole notion. It sought to define women not simply as wives and mothers and daughters, but as citizens with rights of their own, as independent individuals who could participate in the political sphere, which was, as you point out, really a male domain.
And I'm curious, in this same time period in the early American Republic, before the French Revolution went off the rails and devolved into the Reign of Terror and then a military coup, a successful military coup, we saw in 1791 in France the epic Declaration of the Rights of Woman and the Female Citizen, which is one of the most important documents in the history of womanhood in the world. And did we see anything like that in America before Victoria Woodhull runs for the White House in the 1870s?
Well, Mary Wollstonecraft's Vindication of the Rights of Women, which really grows out of the Enlightenment and out of this period of revolution, really was widely circulated in the United States. And many women read it, and you begin to see much discussion of women's roles within the society, and there's a very lively, I think, exchange of ideas about women's status and their proper place. But in Victoria Woodhull's time, you know, another almost a century has gone by here, and here once again, the case is attempting to be made for women's equality. And Victoria Woodhull had a very interesting argument to make about that. She pressed the case. The suffragists were trying to get women included under the terms of the 14th and 15th Amendment. Woodhull goes before the Congress. She was the first woman to testify before a congressional committee, and she appears before the House Judiciary Committee arguing that women already have voting rights, and she calls upon Congress to issue a declaratory act saying that as citizens they are covered under the 14th Amendment and 15th Amendments and already have the right to vote, that no separate amendment was necessary. Imagine if that had succeeded.
Yeah, it's an excellent point,
earlier,
isn't it?
Women would have been able to vote. But I mean, on Congress the declined to do what.
Yeah, on the face of it.
Bidding.
On the face of it, Ellen, it's a terrific point, and you know what? She's right.
Well, she had, you know, it was not as open and shut as one might imagine, and she did have some congressmen supporting her, notably Benjamin Butler, who helped her to draft this thing, and, you know, the public sat up and took notice. This was widely covered, and the suffrage movement was, the suffrage leaders, many of them, not all, were really entranced by Woodhull because they thought, wow, this is one clever woman. And furthermore, she had another really interesting insight, which was when that failed, she sort of said, look, you know, it may be that we can't rally everybody around the philosophical ideal of women's equality, but perhaps a candidate, a compelling candidate, could galvanize the public in the way that Lincoln had galvanized people around the importance of the Union and the position of anti-slavery and so forth. And so she thought, you know, maybe a person who embodied the principles running for the highest office in the land can make this point. And that's really what she wanted to do, although she certainly saw herself as presidential timber, and naturally she was in a minority in considering herself so.
It's similar to what Martin Luther King saw in Rosa Parks in 1955, someone who would a woman especially, who would come to symbolize the entire civil rights movement.
Yes, and, you know, interestingly, that's an interesting point to raise because, like Rosa Parks, you know, Woodhull's presidential run really spoke to a kind of restlessness in the country that went far beyond Woodhull herself. She was an agitator, make no mistake about it, and she had, as I would argue most presidential candidates or perhaps all do, a fairly healthy ego. These people, men and women, are not your average bears. I don't know about you, but I don't think I've ever had a day when I thought I was suited to lead the country. So she had a very healthy self-regard and thought, you know, she was a bit narcissistic and grandiose. So she thought she was suited to it, but she grew out of a larger agitation in the women's movement in the Reconstruction period, and she's an interesting piece of that story that I don't think that aspect of her life has been, the presidential run has been taken quite as seriously as perhaps it should be by historians.
Or Hollywood. I mean, you know, what a great Hollywood feature, a woman running for president in 1872. Of course, we know that Ulysses S. Grant, the incumbent, he won re-election in 1872 against Horace Greeley. What happened to Victoria Woodhull?
Well, Woodhull wound up having trouble. She had a family scandal which brought her down. Not that she would have been victorious otherwise, but the fascinating thing about Woodhull is, you know, we hear a lot today about Hillary Clinton's ties to Wall Street. Victoria Woodhull was a Wall Street broker. She had had a career as a clairvoyant and a spiritualist. She came to New York City, and it turned out that one of the wealthiest men in the country, Cornelius Vanderbilt, was an eccentric man, very drawn to spiritualism and clairvoyance. And Victoria Woodhull made his acquaintance, and Vanderbilt thought that she might be able to put him in touch with his deceased mother, but he found that she was a source of remarkably prescient stock tips. And so he decides to back her and her sister, and they open the first brokerage firm in Wall Street right around the same time that she announces her run for president. So she became very, very wealthy. She self-financed her campaign. But then what happened was she had had an early marriage, a bad marriage, to a guy named Canning Woodhull, who was a physician who'd been called in when she was 15 years old to treat her for a fever. And her parents saw gold and married her off to this man who turned out to be a morphine addict. He spent most of his time, she said, in brothels and bar rooms. She left him. Married a second time, a man named Colonel Blood, who was a Civil War veteran. And in the midst of her presidential run, her mother, who was quite mentally disturbed, went to the local police station and said that she believed her son-in-law, Colonel Blood, was trying to kill her. Well, the police, you know, this was baseless, but the police investigated. It came to light that Victoria Woodhull was living with two men, her former husband and her current husband. Why was that? Woodhull had brought in, and her husband had taken in Canning Woodhull when he was dying of his morphine addiction. And she later said that she felt that it was one of the more humanitarian acts she had ever performed in her life.
Wow.
to provide shelter for him. She was living with two men in Victorian America. She was seen as a woman without moral virtue, and there was a huge blow-up in the press about this, a big scandal. It won't surprise you to know that Woodhull didn't take it sitting down. She went on to accuse in the pages of her newspaper, which she started to promote her candidacy, the most prominent Protestant minister of her time, Henry Ward Beecher, of having an affair with one of his members of his congregation. She wrote about that affair in her newspaper and was arrested under the Comstock laws for obscenity. And on election day in 1872, she was in prison.
Wow. Holy
so that's cow. What happened to the first woman to run for
wow.
president. I know there were those that were hoping to see Hillary Clinton in prison, some of her opponents. It doesn't look like that's going to happen, but it's a funny, not funny, but it's an interesting synergy between the, you know, the kinds of trouble that some of these women candidates had.
Ellen, now we fast forward almost 100 years later, the first woman to serve in both the U.S. House of Representatives and the United States Senate, an outspoken critic of McCarthy, Margaret Chase Smith, had a bid for the White House in 1963. What's the legacy of her run? And why should Americans know about her accomplishments today?
Margaret Chase Smith was one of the most admired women on the national political stage. To be sure, there weren't many of them, but in 1964, when the Gallup did its annual poll of the most admired women by Americans in the world, Margaret Chase Smith ranked high, and that was true year after year. First woman, as you said, elected to the House and to the Senate. She had a very distinguished career in the Senate by the time she decided to run for president. And there was talk about it in the fall of 1963. In fact, President Kennedy, in the last press conference before his trip to Dallas, was asked about how he felt about the possibility of facing a woman candidate, Margaret Chase Smith, in the upcoming, as an opponent in the upcoming election. And he said that he was in a auditorium full of newsmen, and he said that he, even the question provoked laughter. You can actually hear this on the audio tape. The whole idea of a woman president was seen as sort of amusing. But Kennedy took it seriously, and he said she's a formidable political personage and that he would not look forward to it. He knew her very well. And I think grudgingly admired her skills. She had opposed his nuclear test ban treaty. So, but they knew each other very, very well. And so she was a remarkable woman, but almost overnight, after she announced her bid for the presidency, the public sort of the coverage of her switched, and she was written about in the newspapers as someone who was addled or bereft of her reason to think that a woman could actually be president. You know, like, what was wrong? What is this woman thinking that she could be competitive for this job? Some actually said, made a lot of her age. She was 66 years old, that she was too old, and that, you know, a menopausal woman in charge of nuclear weapons, who knows what could happen. She might blow up the world in a fit of pique, etc. So that was what was so striking about her to me. In some ways, there was more sexism in the response to Margaret Chase Smith in 1964, who had had a distinguished career in the Senate, than there was in 1870 and 1872, when Victoria Woodhull, who had no political credentials, had advanced herself.
Yeah, and that's a key takeaway, right? I mean, it's pretty obvious that the sexism in the 20th century was even more apparent, more glaring.
It was.
In the media, more in the press.
You know, Americans during Reconstruction, you know, the discussion about Woodhull was, Americans have been living through these dramatic changes, and some of them were saying, well, you know, could this petticoat government that Woodhull would establish be any worse than the Ulysses S. Grant administration? You know, and so in Smith's case, it was a far different response and atmosphere to her, and she was, I think the prevailing opinion, you know, was very dismissive of her.
Well, and she ran into the buzzsaw of the radical right in the Republican Party that would eventually successfully nominate for the first time a movement conservative in United States Senator from Arizona, Barry Goldwater, who lost the general election, but he won the GOP because movement conservatives have controlled the GOP ever since.
Yeah, she was an interesting figure, Coy, because she was really a moderate Republican. She wasn't a liberal, per se. She was very, very conservative on defense and foreign policy issues. This, of course, in the midst of the Cold War. She was, on the other hand, quite liberal on social policy issues and supported the full array of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society programs. And she was a great friend of Lyndon Johnson's. They got along extremely well. But during the 1950s, she had taken a very courageous stand very, very early when Senator Joseph McCarthy began his anti-communist crusade in Wheeling, West Virginia, and you know, claimed that there were communists working in the State Department at that very moment. And she, that was in the wintertime, and she, in June, gave a speech on the floor of the Senate challenging that what McCarthy was doing, the investigations he was pursuing, and she severely condemned it in something that she called her declaration of conscience. She got a few other senators, and I mean a few, to sign on to that statement, but she was extremely courageous at that moment in her career. And McCarthy threatened her and said, you know, your political career is going to be over. It turns out the pendulum swung, and it was his career that went down the tube. And she came out of that, you know, I think greatly, with her reputation ultimately greatly enhanced.
Ellen Fitzpatrick.
Not enough, so that when she ran for president that, you know, people looked at her and thought, wow, you know, this is a woman of substance and character. When she gave that speech in the Senate, Bernard Baruch said if she was a man, she would be president of the United States.
Wow.
And instead, you know, she just, you know, had a really difficult time being taken seriously when she did it, you know, stake her claim in 64.
Yeah, well, and in 64, all the moderates lost out to Goldwater, Rockefeller, Scranton, Chase. They all lost out to, I'm thinking of Goldwater's response to her conscience is his conscience, the conscience of a conservative, yeah. 1960.
Yeah.
And that certainly won the day. And, of course, the parallels between Goldwater in 64 and Trump in 2016 are compelling. They're just, it's so fascinating.
I think, you know, that the Republican Party would probably be glad to see a Margaret Chase Smith these days, you know, who really was, as I said, quite conservative on national security, on military issues, on foreign policy, but really connected with average working people and really seemed to understand their concerns. And really from the 1940s during the New the 30s when she was helping her husband out, he was actually quite liberal and supported much of the New Deal legislation that Franklin Roosevelt was advancing, and then she kind of carried that forward. So she defies our current political polarization in a way. And she was fiercely independent. One of her colleagues in the Senate once said, and the Republican Party said, if she votes with us, it's a coincidence. You know, they just never knew what she was going to do. And thus she was very frustrating to her party leaders and didn't get a whole lot of support when she was seeking the presidency.
We're talking with historian and author Ellen Fitzpatrick. The new book is The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency. We'll take a very quick break. Ellen will join us in the second half of this program. I'm Coy Barefoot. Welcome back. We're talking with Ellen Fitzpatrick, a historian at the University of New Hampshire. Her new book is The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency. Ellen, before we get to Hillary Clinton, there was, of course, the much-publicized bid for a nomination by Shirley Chisholm in 1972, who not only had to deal with the backlash against the second wave of feminism at the time, but also hundreds of years of American racism.
Shirley Chisholm was a very determined and really very courageous woman. She got into Democratic Party politics in the 1940s when she was a student at Brooklyn College, and she began to attend the meetings of the 17th Assembly District Democratic Club that was run by an Irish political boss and his machine. And these were, the leadership was all white. And yet, many of those living in the neighborhood, including folks in Bedford Stuyvesant, were African American. And she sat in on these meetings and she noticed how the needs of the people in the community were not being addressed very well by these elected officials. And she began to try to work within the system. She began participating and volunteering and then continued those activities after she got out of college, when she went to graduate school, as she was a young professional woman making her way. And then she decided that she was going to try to run herself for political office. She was elected to the New York State Assembly after, by the way, the African Americans within this the district overthrew this old political machine and really took control of the Democratic Party in their neighborhood. And so she went to Albany, and then she was elected in 1968 to the United States Congress, the first African American woman to do so. So she was a very, very brave person who made a made the way in some sense for Clinton and Obama through the kinds of activities she was involved in with others, of course, to break down these impediments to advancement in politics on the basis of gender and race.
And of course, she found herself in President Nixon's crosshairs, isn't that right?
She certainly did, and that's a rather bizarre chapter in her presidential run. Amid the California primary in 1972, she was the victim of a dirty trick engineered by some folks in the Nixon White House who concocted a completely phony press release, which they put out on stolen Hubert Humphrey campaign stationery, in which they claimed that Chisholm had been hospitalized for mental illness, that she was a schizophrenic, that she was a transvestite, that she, you know, had been seen, was arrested after being seen babbling on the streets, that she had been in and out of mental hospitals. I mean, it was just the most deplorable, just a base set of lies. And although this phony press release was put out there, the media didn't publicize it, but it got around. And she was devastated by this. It didn't come to light until Watergate that its origins were in the Nixon White House. And she had been a vociferous critic of Richard Nixon, and in particular of his conduct of the war in Vietnam. So it was a bit gratuitous. I mean, she certainly wasn't a threat to Nixon in 1968 in the midst of her presidential campaign, but I guess there was, you know, it just, she attracted their attention, and this was the result.
So, Ellen, here we are in 2016, a race for the White House that has proven to be historic for more reasons than one. Take Hillary Clinton's candidacy and her political leadership, and put it in the context of the women who have run before her, and help us understand your read on Hillary Clinton's candidacy.
Well, you know what's remarkable about Hillary Clinton? She's often criticized, and again, you know, I preface this by saying, like her or hate her, you know, want to vote for her or dead set against her. When you look at her in the context of history, it seems to me inarguable that she has managed to put together and to a series of assets and to overcome a series of obstacles that no woman in American history ever was able to do. And, you know, it's fascinating to see this historically, because in some ways, like Margaret Chase Smith, who was first elected after her husband died in office and he endorsed her as his successor, we came to know Hillary Clinton through her husband. So in the old days, they called this the widow's mandate. Obviously, she wasn't a widow. She was the first lady. But that's how she came to national prominence, through her husband, and that was it was one of the key ways in which women could get to the national political stage until really the late 20th century. So in that sense, she resembles Margaret Chase Smith. And secondly, I think more notably, it's interesting that what the weapons or tools or assets that she's marshaled to get her where she is today have morphed into liabilities in the context, and in the view of her critics, of course, in the context of the current race. That is, no woman prior to Hillary Clinton was able to amass the financing to be truly competitive in a national presidential race. And she did it in 2008. And she's done it again in 2016. And virtually every woman who has made this effort, and some people who showed great promise, like Elizabeth Dole, who was greatly admired within the Republican Party, she just couldn't get the money. Why couldn't she get the money? Because the party establishment was mindful of the fact that there was still resistance to voting for a woman president, or at least they thought so. They did not want to put their money on a loser. And so Clinton has obviously benefited from the progress that's been made in terms of women's roles in the society, but she's also very adeptly put together the financing, the profile, the experience in domestic and foreign policy, for better or worse, whether you like what she's done or not. No one prior to her has ever been able to put those pieces together, and then to get the support of the party elite. And again, in 2016, these are being cast by her critics as disqualifying, too close to Wall Street, too much backed by big money, old establishment, throwback to the 1990s and her husband's presidency, and of course, all the criticisms of her in her role as Secretary of State. So I would say that you can't lose for winning in American politics. Maybe the moral of the story, I don't know.
At the time of this conversation that we're having now, the GOP has gathered in Cleveland for their convention. And we're certainly going to be hearing quite a bit this week in the press about all of the negatives of Hillary Clinton.
This has been a standard theme throughout the Clinton, both of them, their political careers. And certainly it's something that was true when he was president, and it followed her into her career in the Senate. And then, of course, in her first effort in 2008 to run for the presidency, and then as Secretary of State, and now in 2016. So it's a tune that has been sung for decades now, and I have no doubt that there'll be an orchestra playing it, and people will have to either cover their ears or listen or, you know, do whatever they're going to do over the next several months. So there's going to be much more of this. It's interesting, you know, sort of historically that for one thing, of these women that I profile in the book, three out of the four had difficulties with their husbands. This will not shock anyone, I assume, listening to the program. They also, on the other hand, were very well supported by men in their lives, and in particular Shirley Chisholm's husband was extremely supportive of her career and often said that he was the man behind a great woman. So you know, they also had fiercely loyal companions, for better or worse, and so it's an interesting dimension of the story.
Ellen, what does it mean for a woman today to appear presidential? Because, of course, now in the age of television and social media, it's all about appearances. That is so critical to a successful bid for any public office. What does it mean for a woman to stand up and say, I want to be president? In terms of her appearance, is there almost this implicit weight or responsibility that she comes out strong as a war hawk?
That's a fascinating point that you've raised, because in the early 20th century, most women who were prominent in national, you know, in public life were pacifists, people like Jane Addams, who won the Nobel Peace Prize, and other women that were greatly admired. There was a very strong involvement of women activists in the peace movement in the early 20th century. Emily Balch, who was another Nobel laureate, was also, and had been a professor at Wellesley, was also recognized for her pacifism. And so there had been a lot of activity by women suffragists and other active women in the peace movement. And that is not a winning stance, generally speaking, for a presidential candidate. And I would argue that, you know, a male pacifist probably wouldn't get much traction either.
Right, right.
The American presidency is unusual in involving both the president is not only the chief of state, but he's also, or she, commander-in-chief of the military. So, and generally women, you know, particularly when they had been not involved in combat or in leadership roles in the military, were seen as not suited to that role. So I think that, in fact, has been a big issue. Margaret Chase Smith, I think, was mindful of that, not because she had ambitions to be president. I think she genuinely took the Cold War stance she did, but she was very, very involved. She was on the Armed Services Committee, which Clinton was as well, and they showed their bona fides days in that, on that score. Maureen Dowd of the New York Times attacked Clinton in one of her columns, saying, I think this was in 2008, saying that her ambitions to be president had led her to vote for the war, the Iraq war resolution, and she had a line in it, in the piece, in which she said, you know, Clinton is so ambitious, she knows that no woman can be president who has love beads in her jewelry case. So, you know, whether this in fact is a fair accusation, you know, that this is all calculation, I think, you know, I would argue would be doubtful. But it is, you know, your question raises this very fundamental issue that we don't really have an answer to. What does the woman American president look like? Literally and figuratively, we don't know. We haven't had one. And once we do have one, whether it's Clinton this time or someone else in the future, once that threshold is crossed, then I think that we'll begin to see a greater diversity of people emerge and a wider field of candidates, more women participating at this level. But, you know, this question, particularly in the post-nuclear age, you know, Ferraro was memorably asked when she ran as Mondale's vice president, would you be able to push the button, arguing, you know, could you unleash American nuclear weapons? And she responded by saying, would you be asking me that question if I wasn't a woman? And so, you know, again, this doubt about whether women are equal to that task.
Ellen, you mentioned the future. Just to wrap up here, take a moment and talk to the historian 100 years from now who will have your job to look back and write about the women who ran for president, and they will begin with Hillary Clinton. What is it about 2016 and this historic year that you want to make sure the future historians pay attention to?
Well, I think that a historian looking back 100 years from now to Clinton, whether, again, she wins or loses, will see this as a threshold in which a woman actually did win the nomination of a major political party. She was able to put together the financing. She was able to achieve the national profile. She was able to accumulate the experience. In the end, it's possible that she'll be rejected, but there, again, you know, these have been extremely important pieces of the puzzle that Clinton has put together. And in my book, I end on the note that I describe, you know, a little bit about the current election, and I say that, you know, the quest had become a political contest. That is, some of these barriers that other women candidates had faced and that had been so intractable had been overcome, but that doesn't foretell the outcome, obviously, of the election.
Ellen Fitzpatrick is a professor of history at the University of New Hampshire. Her new book is The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency. Ellen, it's been a great privilege to have you on this program. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for these wonderful questions. I really enjoyed it. Thanks, Coy.